Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA Podcast. We have a great episode for you today. We're going to go deep into the Jimmy Butler trade and figure out what the hell Chicago was thinking. We're also going to recap the 2017 NBA Draft, talk a little bit about the D'Angelo Russell and Dwight Howard trades, and hopefully wrap things up with a little primer on free agency. Before we get all that, just wanted to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find all of our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so follow us there, subscribe, download, leave some reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports and for their NBA content at FanRag NBA. Though the draft is over, we still have a lot of great draft coverage, how prospects fit with their teams. We already have a 2018 mock draft coming out, and then free agency is only a week away. So we're going to have a lot of good stuff over the coming weeks involving that as well. So again, FanRag Sports at FanRag Sports on Twitter. Joining me as always this week is my trusty co-host Morten Jensen. Mort, how's it going?
It's going well, Brian, because, my apologies, we are being joined by two people who I have had internet relationships with. That sounded way more creepier than I intended for about 14 years, I think.
That's, yeah, we have, so our normal third co-host, Sarah Chalea, could not join us today. She had to work. So instead, we have two special guests this week. One, Mark Deeks. You may know him as the proprietor of Sham Sports, also does some great work overseas, loves the NBA. So Mark, how's it going? Thanks for joining us.
Morning, gentlemen. Thank you for having that. Morten, I didn't think we were going to talk about our long-distance internet relationship, but there we go. Now everyone knows. And can I have my ice cream maker back, please?
We will settle the divorce after this podcast. Mark, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can follow your work?
Yeah, so I'm Mark Deeks NBA on Twitter, which is the primary place to find what I do. I have a website that's covered in dust that we are planning to relaunch, but have been since about 2009. And my work for Give Me Sport UK, Give Me Sport NBA, the NBA's official UK media partner. And yeah, but mostly head to the Twitter, and you can see it's the side of my face.
Nice. Good. Yeah, definitely check Deeks out. There are a few people on the internet who are more knowledgeable about the NBA and especially about the salary cap. So give him a follow. Our other guest joining us this week, another Mark Karantzoulis. Mark, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me back. Appreciate that.
Yeah. So again, where can our listeners find you on Twitter and where can they find your work?
Yeah, they can find me at Mark K. NBA. Not much work to plug at the moment. It's been a bit quiet on my end, but that's fine. But yeah, you can get me at Mark K NBA for all my Twitter ramblings on the Chicago Bulls.
Perfect. Yeah, and so let's dive right into the Chicago Bulls. Mort and Mark, I just have to start things off by apologizing because, you know, it's been Jimmy Butler has been mentioned in trade rumors, frankly, for years. You know, at the draft last June, it seemed like something was about to happen. At the trade deadline, it seemed like something was about to happen. This week, Monday, we got rumors that the Minnesota Timberwolves were in on him. And you figure, oh, it's just, you know, much ado about nothing again. Within minutes of the draft starting, Markelle Fultz is like on the stage Thursday night. And then ESPN's Mark Stein breaks the news that they are close to consummating a deal with the Timberwolves. Casey Johnson of the Chicago Tribune followed up a few minutes later and confirmed that the deal was in place. So the Bulls gave up Jimmy Butler and their number 16 overall pick to Minnesota in exchange for Zach LaVine, Chris Dunn, and the number 7 pick. So Mark K, I'm going to start with you and just ask, was that enough? Was that the return you were hoping or expecting for Jimmy Butler?
For me personally, it wasn't enough, particularly when you think about this deal or the parameters of this deal and you sort of cast your mind back 12 months and it's essentially the same deal that was on the table 12 months ago. Then the only real difference, I guess, is the pick swap. But for me, it's not enough. I was firmly on board with trading Jimmy if it made sense. And to me, making sense meant getting hopefully a top five pick in this draft, maybe a future pick next season, and a young prospect of sorts. That would have been my ideal trade package. I don't think the Bulls got anywhere close to that, so I'm a bit disappointed with the haul, particularly when you think about the year Chris Dunn had in his rookie season, the fact that he's a 23-year-old, and Zach LaVine's recovering from an ACL injury, which, as a Bulls fan, has me very very tentative. But, yeah, personally, I don't think the Bulls got anywhere near enough. Everyone's reporting that that was the best offer on the table, but if that's the best offer, don't make the deal.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, of course, you know, no general manager is going to come out, except for Vlade, who was, after the DeMarcus deal, he did say he had better offers, I guess. But no other general manager is ever going to come out and say, well, we had better offers, but we decided to wait, and then they went down. So, of course, the Bulls are going to sell it that way. Deeks, I know you are also underwhelmed by the return they got. Can you explain, like, why did they include the 16 pick? That's what is boggling. You know, I'm already underwhelmed by Dunn, LaVine, and number 7 for Butler, as is. But then when they included 16, it was just, it was so Bulls. So what do you think, why did they agree to that?
Don't know. I'm not going to give you an answer that I don't believe. I don't know, really. I don't know how they considered themselves to have sufficiently little leverage that they had to do that. I was like my namesake Mark K. Nothing against the Butler trade in principle, but against that one. Don't worry too much about Chris Dunn's rookie year. Yeah, it was poor, but he's still relatively young. It's 1 year. It's point guard. It's fine. He's still a legitimate prospect. He doesn't have to be a star prospect to be a legitimate one. In terms of getting the haul that they got, Mark said about wanting a young prospect in return. Well, Zach LaVine is a pretty good one in that respect. That, as the foundation of a deal, isn't the worst. But the inclusion of the 16, it just doesn't make sense. Where did they have the leverage to do that? if you consider that Butler was the first big piece to fall, not counting Dwight anymore, that's gone. If he's the big piece to fall on the trade market for all the teams who want that third star, he was the first one to go. Why is he gone comparatively cheaply? You can understand if Paul George goes comparatively cheaply now in light of the fact that he's clearly said he's going in free agency. So if he is the second domino, then that's going to be a bit lower. That'll be reflecting his trade value. But that wasn't the case with Butler. Yeah, he's a bit disgruntled in Chicago, but he's supposed to be. Things aren't going very well. So why, if they had potentially all of the suitors, all of the teams out there that are looking for that third player, even that second player, which he is, he's a top... Do you know what? I love the fact that people seem to call Jimmy Butler a top 12 player in the league these days. What you're basically saying is he's 12th. Anyway, he's really good. If that then gives them leverage. His free agency is coming up, but it's not coming up too quickly. He will be eligible extension. The rules are slightly more flexible now. He's still young. He's still improving. He just put up a career year. He's a two-way player, and how many legitimate two-way star players are there these days? I don't get it. Now, I get the trade in him. I get finally taking a direction. I get wanting a decent young prospect in Zach LaVine who could be a 20-point-per-game scorer if we ignore efficiency. I get the value in the number 7 pick. But, Brian, to your question of why do they include the 16th, I have no idea. I just don't think they value picks that much, which doesn't seem to be easy to reconcile with the idea that they're now rebuilding. We should remember... Sorry, gentlemen, I know you're Bulls fans. I used to be. I gave it up 3 years ago. Timed it well. I know you're Bulls fans, so this would be tough to hear. But remember, they traded both Gary Harris and Yusef Nurkic for Doug McDermott. All right. Now, both of those players are way better than Doug McDermott. But even notwithstanding that fact, even if we pretended they were neutrals, that's how little they valued those mid-first-round picks. Second-round picks, as we know, they have no time for whatsoever, unless, of course, they end up making them, in which case, oh, we were surprised that guy fell that far. They just don't have this value on picks that they should do. You can't rebuild without valuing picks. They valued the 7 enough to want it, but they valued the 16 sufficiently little to throw it in. It's a 9-pick difference in a 5-player draft. It's not that big of a difference between 17 and 6. So if you're willing to give away the 16, you're not assigning that much value to the 7. I don't know. I really don't know why they did that. And it changed the deal. Dunn, LaVine, and 7 for Butler is one thing. you can live with that. But including the 16 as well, a swap of 9 places, why?
Yeah, I think, I mean, to the point about Levine, you know, he is off the ACL tear, but he did come off, you know, a career year this year. He averaged almost 19 points per game as a third option. So, you know, assuming he comes back from the ACL, which, you know, it's not the career ender, the career changer that it was even 5-10 years ago, he could be the foundation of the new Bulls. You know, as you said, you know, Chris Dunn was very underwhelming as a rookie, shot like 38% from the floor, had a PER of 8. That said, A, he's already probably the best point guard on the Bulls roster, because you have to assume Rondo is going to get bought out, which speaks more to the Bulls' point guard depth than anything else. But, you know, he did show some defensive chops there, so maybe he covers for Levine in that regard. I guess the big concern with Levine is that he'll be a restricted free agent next summer, so you're already, you know, you're probably going to end up paying him. You basically have to pay whatever he wants. You're probably going to end up maxing him. So you just have to hope he comes back healthy. Mort, first of all, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry, because this is frankly karma, because you've been trolling Sarah for the last like 3 episodes about Manu retiring, and then now the Bulls piss away Jimmy Butler for 5 cents on the dollar. But
it's actually my fault this happened, so like every Bulls fan in the world should just go after me,
right? Yeah. So I mean, we did a thing, a roundtable of B-Ball Breakdown today about the trade. You like the two marks are not a huge fan. Go into, you know, what is bothering you most about this deal?
Well, I mean, like the two marks, I agree with the fact that Jimmy Butler being traded is sort of like picking a side, and I get it. It's fair that they move on from Butler and start something new. It's the return that I'm bothered by. Like, they use Jimmy as this foundation of, okay, we're moving him and now we're starting like a rebuilding process. But, oh, well, you know what? We don't value draft picks. Oh, we're going to ship off number 38 for cash. I mean, how is that starting like a rebuilding process in a proper manner? It's not. And like Deeks alluded to, like, if you don't value draft picks and you're going into a rebuilding process, and I even believe that John Paxson said that they would, you know, build through the draft, like, then their actions doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Financially speaking, I'm not really that intrigued by the Zach LaVine thing as well, because he's coming up for an extension pretty soon. Because the cap has spiked, his deal is, I believe, more expensive than what Jimmy's is right now. So he's actually going to cost more than Jimmy would have 2 years from now. That's kind of bothersome, and I would not have made the deal, generally speaking. Like, if I'm there with Jimmy, the biggest trade asset on my roster, by far, a top 10 player, top 10, top 12, whatever, and I'm getting those kind of offers, I'm not doing it. And one thing that we've all seemed to like ignore is the fact that the Bulls should have done a better job building around Butler. Like, last year, that was their shot, and they spent their money on Rondo and Wade, which most certainly is not the way to build around Butler. So it's, and then I feel as though they kind of used that as momentum to like, oh, justify a Jimmy trade. Well, you gone fucked up before. Like, you should have just done it right. You should have built around him right beforehand. Like, yeah. No, it's really, it's concerning if you're a Bulls fan as well. Like, just going forward, these deals seem to be a theme.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever they get fleeced, they even add in a draft pick.
Right. I mean,
it's just not good management.
Yeah, it's very similar. I mean, when they gave up 16, it felt so similar to the Taj Gibson deal at the trade deadline, where they were the ones who threw it a second round pick for no reason, like you would expect OKC.
Oh, well, they got their point guard of the future, Brian, right. Cameron Payne, remember?
Right.
This is their third point guard of the future within a year.
Yeah. Oh, because Michael Carter-Williams being the first?
No, Jerian Grant.
Oh, right. Oh, God.
They were high. Oh. They were high on Grant. Oh. Like, Mark Kay, I remember, you and I, we wrote together at Bulls Confidential, and I remember a lot of the conversation was centered around Jerian Grant.
Oh, my God. Bulls fans, yeah, well, you are, I mean, always welcome to be Sixers fans.
I like Jerry.
I'm considering that.
All right, so let's turn to the Minnesota side of things for a second. You guys as Bulls fans have seen Jimmy more than the average NBA fan. You know, Deeks, you call him a top 12 player. Mort, you've been saying top 10. The point is, he is, you know, if he's not the surefire superstar, like franchise changing player, like a LeBron James or Kevin Durant, he is one step below. You know, he is an excellent multi-time all-star. So Mark K, how do you see him fitting next to Wiggins, Rubio, and Towns in particular in Minnesota?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because we're assuming here that Rubio stays, and mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily sure if that's going to be the case. And Rubio was available at the trade deadline. I think there was reports yesterday of deals for Rubio getting done. So I don't know if Rubio is going to be in the picture, but if he is, and depending what Tibbs does at power forward, their spacing is going to be a problem. So that'll be interesting to see how it works out. But I think more so for Wiggins, Jimmy Butler is exactly the type of player you probably want to put next to Andrew Wiggins, in the sense of a guy you want to be a mentor for him. Mm-hmm. So when you watch Wiggins play, he can clearly score the ball. He's shown a lot from a scoring potential. I did not expect that from him. And I was expecting more defensively, but he's been quite poor defensively, in my opinion. But with Tibbs there, and then now Butler, I guess, carrying Tibbs' message onto the court as a player, I think it's going to be perfect for Andrew Wiggins. And yesterday, I was just thinking about this trade, and I was just fantasizing about Jimmy Butler and Karl Towns in the pick and roll, and how Jimmy Butler's going to be able to play with a legitimate stretch big now. And I think that'll be absolutely fantastic for his game as well as Towns's.
Yeah.
So I think the fit's going to be really good, and depending what they do at point guard, if they can maybe move on from Rubio and find a shooter at point guard, or maybe instead of playing Jang and Towns, starting those guys, maybe finding a stretch four, I think that will be a really good fit for Minnesota, and I don't see why they can't head towards the playoffs now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think they have around $20 million to spend in free agency this summer, so this deal did not restrict what they can do on that front. You know, there are reports that Patrick Beverley is being shopped from Houston. He could be a really interesting fit there if Rubio does get moved. You know, a Beverley, Butler, Wiggins, Towns, good luck scoring against that team. So, yeah.
Gibson?
Yeah, Gibson, right? Yeah.
I've been running that one for a year now.
I know. Yeah, Mark, I am glad you brought up the mentorship, especially because I think that's where I'm most intrigued by this possibility. Because Wiggins, when he came into the league, it seemed like defense was going to be his calling card, and he hasn't really hit that potential yet. But like, who better to learn from aside from like Kawhi Leonard or Draymond Green than a Jimmy Butler? And Jimmy Butler could turn Wiggins, like, Wiggins has the physical tools to be a first team all defense player. He just hasn't figured that out yet, but now he's going to have Butler in his ear teaching him the ropes, like teaching him how to have that mindset, what to look for, how to shut people down. That is going to be a terrifying force on that end. Deeks, I want to ask you though, because, you know, Mark K mentioned Rubio is not a great shooter. Wiggins is also not a great shooter. Butler, he hit a career high number of threes this past year, but you know, he's not Stephen Curry or Klay Thompson or anything like that. So I think it's fair to say shooting is the big concern about this new Minnesota core moving forward. How do you see them rectifying it, or are you that worried about it?
Well, I don't think that Butler and Wiggins are a particularly good pairing. That's not a reflection on the deal. The value was so good, you got to take it. And of course, Tibbs loves Butler, why wouldn't he? I think a key way to rectify it would be to stop giving them both 37 minutes a game every night, like he's going to do, maybe work some shooters in off the bench. Notwithstanding that, I agree with Mark K that Rubio is not going to be the ideal fit. So he's a quality player who deserves a quality price, but alongside a Butler and Wiggins pairing, the nature of his game is not particularly well fitting. Defensively, like you say, Wiggins has been disappointing. He can do it. He does sometimes do it, but he often does not do it. He is increasingly lazy on defense, especially last year. He's also not rebounding. He's not doing the things he should be doing. Instead, he's trying to become the world's greatest mid-range shooter, which he shouldn't be doing. So it's not the best pairing for now. Doesn't matter, of course. do what you got to do. They got tremendous value. With regards to the stretching, Karl Anthony Towns and his completely flat-footed jump shot is actually proving to be quite good in that area. Jeng can shoot a little bit. So they're not going to be a good shooting team, but it's not going to hold them back necessarily. The key becomes now how good can they be defensively. It should be good. Then again, it should have been a lot better than it was last year based on potential. Towns, good defensive player. Jeng, reasonable-ish. Butler and Wiggins should be a great wing pairing. And Rubio, although he can be beaten off the dribble, has good hands and can impart good ball pressure at the guard spot. That should be a decent defensive five. And if anyone needs changing out of it, I'd argue it should be Jeng. But he's a good player, let's be fair to him. That should be the foundation, and Lord knows Tibbs should be the deliverer of, a defensive unit that propels them into the 50-win range. Don't know if it will. I'd rather regrettably thought much the same of last year. Didn't work out. But it could be, especially on the wings there. That said, it's not an ideal fit, particularly offensively, and I think the main means of fixing that is again, regrettably, a little bit more flexibility from Tibbs, because Wiggins is taking about 700 mid-range jumpers a year. I know he lacks a three-point range right now, but that doesn't mean take a two. That means, you know, find something else, find other options. They need more shooters on the roster, certainly. You can't rely on Emmanuel Bielitsa. But they also need to stop running these possessions with that result in the mid-range jump shots. And we have to, knowing, you know, we've all got Bulls history here, we have to accept that Tibbs is partly that, because he did the same in Chicago. It's ultimately kind of what got him fired. So what they now have is the majority of the pieces of the puzzle to get themselves relevant. Obviously, their current team, unless Towns just keeps on going and going and going, which he might, their current team is not championship potential anytime soon, but they are quite a few steps up the ladder now with the Towns and Butler pairing and some good players around them. So now Tibbs has to make that work. He has to temper the minutes. There's no point running players off the floor. They're going to wind up like Deng. He has to be able to diversify that offense, increase the spacing. He can do that with the personnel he's got. Some added personnel elsewhere, less post players, more shooters, that can be done. But the pieces are there, especially defensively, and now Tibbs has to mould it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's no question. As you said, you know, it's not the perfect fit, but if you're only giving up what they gave up, it's a no-brainer, right? You give up those pieces and figure it out later. So, Mort, I want to ask you, you know, you had the Timberwolves as a playoff team last year, which proved a little premature. Do you think they're facing a lot of competition in the West, obviously, but do you think they are a playoff team next year?
Yeah, I even went as far as saying I think they are a second-round team. Mm-hmm. I think they could get that far, mostly because Jimmy, I believe, would propel them that far, especially combined with the fact that Karl Anthony Towns is going to get better, Andrew Wiggins is going to get better. Tibbs will now have a whole year of data under him with the Timberwolves, so I think he's more inclined to improve as a coach as well, because he knows his guys a little bit better, and also because I do believe that Taj Gibson will sign there, giving Tibbs some sort of known commodity on the floor, and Taj is an excellent defender that will only add to the defensive potential. I could be wrong and he could go somewhere else, but right now I'm not seeing like a better partner out there. So I believe the Wolves will be in the playoffs, and like Mark said, not championship contenders, obviously, but definitely an improved squad that should make a lot of noise. Here's my hot take, Brian. I know you love hot takes.
I sure do.
I believe that if this team comes off, you know, hot in the early part of the season, and it's due to Jimmy, I think he can carry it to the extent that he throws himself into the MVP debate.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean,
I think this team is just perfect for him, especially like Mark K alluded to with the pick and roll with Towns, you know, the pick and pop options as well. I think this just opens up Jimmy tremendously.
Yeah, I mean, on the playoff note, if Jimmy Butler got last year's Bulls to the playoffs, you know, he didn't have a single teammate nearly as talented as Andrew Wiggins, much less Karl Anthony Towns. So, yes, the West is very tough and only got more challenging last night. But, you know, the Clippers, depending on what happens in free agency, could fall apart. Memphis, one injury away from falling apart. Dallas is going to be more frisky next year. Denver, who knows? They, you know, they have a bunch of question marks. So, like, Minnesota's in that range where they could at least be, like, the frisky six seed that you don't want to face in the first round, and if they get the right matchup, yeah, second round team doesn't seem totally out of the question. We'll obviously see what happens in free agency. So let's now seg into the NBA draft itself, and we can, you know, I want to basically go through, we don't need to hit every single pick, so let's just do the big winners and losers of the draft. Obviously, the four of us agree Chicago is probably the biggest loser of the night, not only because of the Jimmy trade, but they, you know, they take Jordan Bell at 38, a guy who a lot of people like, a lot of people thought was a first rounder, sell him to the Golden State Warriors for $3.5 million, which marks the second straight year that a team needlessly sold a productive player to the Golden State Warriors, the first being Pat McCaw from the Milwaukee Bucks last year. I want to instead focus more on Lauri Markkanen, who the Bulls took at 7. So the first six picks went pretty chalk, as most mock drafts had Fultz to the Sixers, Lonzo Ball to the Lakers, Jason Tatum to the Celtics, Josh Jackson to the Suns, De'Aaron Fox to the Kings, Jonathan Isaac to the Magic. So 7 was always, you know, even when the Timberwolves had the pick, that was kind of seen as the point where things could get wild. Mark Kay, what do you think of Lowry as the number 7 pick? Were you a fan of that one, or would you have liked to see them take someone else?
Yeah, look, keeping with the theme of me being disgruntled, I wasn't happy with the pick. Yeah. Look, Markkanen, I guess, was slotted to go in that range, so he was going to go anywhere between 7 and 10, let's call it that. So I don't think it's a reach at all, necessarily. But personally, if I had the 7th pick, I wouldn't be picking Markkanen at that point. I would have taken Dennis Smith, and I think Dallas are a huge winner because of that. I think he's probably got the most upside of the guys taken in that, say, 7 to 12 range. So, and if you think about where the Bulls are at, they really needed to hit on the, at least in my opinion, the best player available as well as the guy that had the best ceiling. And in this case, I think that was Dennis Smith. And they didn't do it. They took Markkanen. I think Markkanen can definitely be a good pro. He's obviously an incredible shooter, and I would assume that translates from college to the NBA. But again, I'm a tentative Bulls fan because I was promised lots of things about Nikola Mirotic's shooting, and even Doug McDermott sort of fell off on his shooting last year. So if he's going to be a role-playing jump shooter, I think he will probably still be a good shooter. He should be fine. But look, I would have taken Dennis Smith, so I'm not too fond of this Markkanen pick, particularly as well that the Bulls are going to be a rebuilding team. Who knows what's going to happen with Dwayne Wade, how long he's going to be with the team, and even if he is with the team, how engaged he's going to be, and Rajon Rondo as well. And the reason I bring up those two guys is they're really the only two that can really create anything off the bounce. And for a guy like Markkanen, who's going to be a rookie big that's probably going to be put in a lot of pick and rolls, going to be out there to stretch the floor, he's going to be needing someone to create some shots for him, particularly initially. So if Wade doesn't last the season and he's bought out, and if Rondo is bought out now or he doesn't come back, then I'm really concerned with how his development is going to go, particularly if the Bulls pretty much give the entire point guard minutes to Chris Dunn, Jerian Grant, and Cam Payne, who are not playmakers at all. I think the effect of that will be someone like Markkanen will suffer. So it'll be interesting to see how the Bulls develop him from here on out. I can complain about the pick as much as I want, but the main thing now is development, and that's where my concern lies at the moment.
Yeah, that's a reasonable concern. You could always bring back Michael Carter-Williams. I hear he's a former Rookie of the Year, so he's pretty good, right?
Yeah, supposedly.
But yeah, I think it's fair. You know, I'm with you in thinking Dennis Smith Jr. at 7 would have been the best prospect available on the board at that point. But, you know, you figure the Bulls probably, they didn't just trade for Chris Dunn to take another point guard. So it's a place where BPA versus fit came into the equation. And I guess for that reason, you know, I would have at least understood the pick a little bit more if they weren't going to bring back Mirotic. But then afterward, they said they're going to try to re-sign him too. So if they re-sign him, I just don't even remotely understand the pick. If they don't, you know, I guess it's like the heir apparent to Mirotic, and he's cheaper, he's on a rookie deal for 4 years, at least he fills a role. So Oh, Bulls. Deeks, can you explain just why do teams sell second round picks, and why do they do it to the Warriors?
Well, they generally don't anymore. If it makes you feel better, they can immediately take that $3.5 million they got for Jordan Bell and give $3 million of it to buying out Rondo. So there you go. That might make you feel a little bit warmer about it all. Nice to know the money's going somewhere useful. I'm all right with Markkanen. I'm also all right with bringing back Mirotić to the point that I encourage it. They're not too obsolete with each other, and even if they are, it's a matter of asset consolidation. Do you consider something with Markkanen? There is plenty of long-term value to be had there, even if not as a player. What he is a seven-footer and one of the best seven-footer shooters there's ever been. Now, whether he can defend or rebound or create at the NBA level are very valid questions, but what is a known fact already is that that guy is probably, well, I say known fact, probably, you know what I mean. He's probably going to be a 40% decent volume three-point shooter at the NBA level with an unblockable shot. Now, if that doesn't fit in Chicago in the short or medium term, fine, but it'll fit somewhere. So get that guy in, get him getting the shots up, and use that market. Chicago, as we've talked about before, aren't good with asset consolidation. They never trade high. How many players have left in free agency with getting nothing back? Ben Gordon,
Joakim Noah.
Taj basically did. Luol Deng basically did because they got a pick that they used to pay Rondo. They routinely just let players go, or they trade them at the lowest ebb, going back to Tyson Chandler and Ben Wallace back in the day. Eddie Curry as well, though, they got away with that one. Now, they've pretty much done the same again with Butler. As we've talked about, that's not trading as high as they could do. So what they need then, because they're not particularly judicious with assets, is as many as they can get. Mirotić represents one if he's brought back. Bring him back, because if he walks again, you've got nothing for someone good. Markkanen represents one because he may not be the star that you want in a rebuild, but he doesn't necessarily have to be. There will be value down the road. It's a bit of a frustration in a way, because personally I viewed this as a top six and the rest draft. I think there is a big gap between Jonathan Isaac at six and anyone else down there. Dennis Smith, yeah, okay, fine, I get it, I see it, but I do think there is a tier there. There'll be one or two sleepers to come through because the draft is purely a guessing game, but that's the way I see it. Thus, seven wasn't the ideal pick. Nonetheless, I'm all right with Markkanen. I'm all right with bringing back Mirotić. Very, very unall right with selling the second round pick, because even if you don't want Jordan Bell, or even if you don't want anyone else out there, look at what everyone else is getting for their second round picks. They're getting future second-round picks. Teams are always trading into the second rounds. You can use second-round picks to get yourself a decent veteran. Okay, not Chicago's priority right now, but it at least was an option. A future second-round pick, kick the can down the road, combine them, move into a late first. But they don't value these things. They've never valued these things. Look how many second-rounders they gave up for McDermott. They gave up two more to move Calderon, who they never wanted, to move Anthony Randolph, who they never wanted, threw one into the OKC trade. They don't want him. They want money more. Ouch.
Yeah. I mean, that is a good point about Markkanen being an asset, because what you figure, you know, Ryan Anderson seems like the comp a lot of people are using for him. And like, Ryan Anderson isn't an all-star, but he signed a 4-year, $80 million deal. And, you know, he's had a productive 10-year NBA career he's going to once this contract is over. So it's not like a Jahlil Okafor situation where, you know, a highly ranked prospect is going to become obsolete in 2 years because the NBA is changing. Like, at least Markkanen's one signature skill, which is long-range shooting, is only becoming more popular, whereas a guy like Okafor, you know, his ISO post-up bully ball can't overwhelm his defensive concerns. So that is a fair point about Markkanen. I'm glad, Mark K, you brought up Dallas as a big winner because of Dennis Smith Jr. I completely agree on that. You know, especially if they bring back Nerlens Noel, it's just a perfect pick and roll combination. You got Dirk to pick and pop. So, Mort, I want you, who else did you like as a winner of this year's draft?
Oh, Utah. Because they got Donovan Mitchell.
Oh, yeah, your boy.
Yeah, that's my boy. I have him on my big board. Remember, not my personal mock draft, but on my big board, I had Mitchell as number three, which is insanely high, and I know a lot of people will call that illogical. I'll take it. It's fair. But, you know, a supremely gifted athlete, strong defensive-minded player, has some lapses, but he's still young. developing offensively. He increased his three-point volume tremendously, and still his accuracy increased by 10 percentage points. So, you know, there's a lot to like there. And when you get him for Trey Lyles at number 24, that's a good deal. I mean, that's fair value, and you bolster your backcourt. You also get like a guarantee for if George Hill walks, he can step into that sort of role, because Hill isn't that traditional point guard where he handles the ball like 80-85% of the time. He spots up a lot and he moves without the ball. You can do the same with Donovan Mitchell, and also he's a strong defender, so there wouldn't be any problems there, maybe initially, but not down the line. So I'm absolutely in love with what Utah did.
Yeah, they traded 24 and Lyles for 13. Lyles, you know, impressed as a rookie, had an underwhelming sophomore year. 24, it could have come back to bite them because OG slipped to 23, but the Raptors stopped his sled. So after 23, you know, there was no one jumps out as like a can't miss prospect there. So yeah, I liked that trade a lot. I feel like weird saying this, but I think the Sacramento Kings had one of the best drafts of anyone yesterday. I think De'Aaron Fox at 5, you know, is going to be a nice compliment to Buddy Hield on both ends. Hield can shoot, De'Aaron Fox can't, so that, you know, that people are not super concerned about Fox and say he can improve, but that at least covers up that deficiency. Hield is not a great defender. Fox reminds me a lot of a Patrick Beverley type, just an absolute bulldog, freak athlete. So, and apparently, I mean, this goes to say about all of the Kings picks, apparently, but they're all seemingly high culture guys, like very competitive. They're not going to sulk if they lose 50 games, in theory. So then they also had 10. They traded that down to 15 and 20. I got nervous about trading 10 because Malik Monk was on the board, but I guess if you have Hield, you're not trying to undermine him. And, you know, that was Sacramento's thing for a couple of years there. Just take the best shooting guard available in the late lottery and see how it plays out. But they moved down. 15, they got Justin Jackson, who broke out at UNC this past year. 20, they got Harry Giles, I think he was like the number 2 recruit this past year until his knee injuries. You know, he was very limited at Duke, only averaged about 4 points a game. Reminds me a lot of the Skal Labissiere pick from last year where, you know, super high recruit, didn't play well in college, might take him a little while, kind of a high-risk pick, but at 20, who cares? It's your third first-round pick. If you miss at 20, it's like, it's not going to set your franchise back a decade. And then Frank Mason at 34. They don't have a single point guard under contract right now, so he's at least an interesting flyer to take as a backup, as a third-string guy. Mark Kay, who else did you like from this year's draft class?
Yeah, I mean, just to back up on what you said there on the Kings, I was really happy to see them take Giles, because I thought one of the moves that Portland should have made was using one of their 3 first-round picks that they had on Harry Giles. But they sold those to the Kings, and for the Portland, if you think about Portland, they're pretty much capped out. I would have used one of those picks to ship off a contract, preferably Evan Turner. But I thought Harry Giles would have been really good for them, you know, getting a cost-controlled asset for 4 years on a guy that has plenty of upside for a team that's capped out. I thought that would have been good, but the Kings made that deal, and I thought that was a really good draft day trade for them. So you mentioned the Kings. I really liked what Dallas did, obviously. I mentioned that before. Charlotte getting Monk at 11 was pretty good value. I thought Monk was for sure going top 10. I thought he might go either 7 or 8, but he fell to 11. So I think Monk going to Charlotte was really good value. The fact that the Warriors bought Jordan Bell, they could have been just sitting there, I mean, quite content with themselves winning a championship and winning it so convincingly, but it's not what the Warriors do. They just continuously are on the front foot, and they go out there and get a guy who will have insanely good value at 38, and they go out there and pay $3.5 million for him. So this, who knows if Bell actually becomes a player or not, but just the fact that they had the will, I guess, to go out there and do so was really impressive to me, particularly when the Bulls were selling those picks. I was kind of in awe of what they did. But the other one for me was Toronto. So getting OG at 23, I think that's pretty much a steal for mine.
Mm-hmm. Yep, all of those I agree with. I also can't believe we've got 40 minutes of this podcast and I haven't brought up the Sixers a single time. But the Sixers got Markelle Fultz, so they're winners. Even though...
Yeah, of course.
Brian Colangelo, I will say... He kind of adopted the Bulls approach where they had 4 second round picks and he sold 2 of them, one of whom Juwan Evans I really liked, and I was really excited when I saw that name come up on Twitter, and then I saw they traded to the Clippers and I got a little bummed. But Jonah Bolden's an interesting guy, 36. I like Lasort at 50. Like, I remember him being mentioned as a possible fringe first rounder for a while, so that one's interesting.
I like him too.
Yeah. And then, you know, the trade they made at 25. They got, I'm not even going to bother saying his name because I'm just going to murder the pronunciation. But a 7'2" guy who they're going to draft and stash. I mean, they gave up an OKC top 20 protected 2020 pick. So, you know, I saw they traded a future first for him and I got very nervous. And then I saw it was that one. I was like, okay, I don't care. That's fine. It's probably going to be 2 seconds. So, yeah, Philly, another big winner for me. Mark Deeks, bring some negativity here. Who, aside from Chicago, did you not like in this, in terms of teams' performance in the draft last night?
Yeah, let's get the grumpy Englishman to bring the negative. Awesome. I'm actually glad you asked that because I was going to say some positives, but Mark K pretty much said the same ones I was going to say. I do want to add before I get into my negative world of pain that Sacramento, for all the problems they have as a team, they were actually pretty good on the last Thursday in June. 2 years ago, they got Willie Cauley-Stein, who personally I'm extremely biased towards, but has to be the greatest 8.4 rebound player that's ever taken the court. last year, they moved down 5 spots from 8 to 13, and in doing so, picked up an extra first-round pick. The rights to Bogdan Bogdanovic, who's an NBA-caliber rotation player, is essentially like picking up another first-round pick, and a second. All for moving down 5 spots. They moved down 5 spots again this year and got 2 players at 15 and 20 that I would argue are going to be better than the one that Portland picked at 10. They're pretty good at drafting these days, and Fox. So, yeah, they have a roster absolutely stacked with their rookie-scale contracts now. If anything, it's already full. But that's a pretty great start. They just need one or two of them to come through with stars, and they're there. As for the... You asked me before about the selling of second-round picks. Philadelphia's selective aggression in getting Fultz, and also the Latvian, I can't pronounce it either, but he's a good drafting stash, by the way. He's got plenty of offensive talent. He just needs to toughen up and actually board. That is a pretty good use of their assets for selective aggression, certainly in getting Fultz and getting that core. They have to sell the seconds, I think, being fair to them, on account of running out of space because of what Hinkie did. They've got so many picks, both now and in the future, that space is already at a premium. The roster's getting full up. Korkmaz still needs to come over. I guess they could have tried to consolidate them for future picks down the road, but you know, space runs out. The flip side of the Utah deal that Morton loves so much is that Denver ended up getting Tyler Lydon at 24 and Trey Lyles in exchange for Mitchell. Now, I don't like that for them. I like most things that Denver do in the draft. They're very good at it. The Jokic pick is going to be one of the greatest in a generation. It already is. Jamal Murray last year looks like the point guard of the future. They have a knack for finding quality at value. But because of that, what are they going to do with Lydon? What are they going to do with Lyles? Are either of those players going to be better than Hernan Gomez is going to be? Hernan Gomez is already an excellent stretch four. He shot 40% from 3 as a rookie and has great energy, athleticism and defense. Lyles and Lydon, they're now competing with him for space. Was this a deal that was done purely because they're assuming that Gallinari is going to walk? Possibly. And that's a shame because that's not the outcome you want to see from a lottery pick. So I don't really like it for them, but I will defend Sacramento to the hilt on draft nights.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, everyone was saying the Kings had a good draft. It was like the Twilight Zone. I mean, I guess, you know, Donald Trump is president, so it's been the Twilight Zone for 7 months now. But
they seem to be pretty good at it, and yeah. I can't ignore the fact that in making that trade down last year, they did go from Marquise Chris to Papagiannis. Now, Papagiannis needs a lot of time. He might be good, but Chris was one of the standouts of last year's particularly forgettable draft. And the end of the year, he proved himself to be a very good new age four. So, yeah, it's not for nothing they traded down for 5 picks, but they got great value doing it. And they've done so again. I know you wanted negativity. Sorry, let's give the Kings their due. They've made a lot of mistakes on the trade market and they've got no free agency Leo, but they have acquired a lot of draft picks and they're doing all right with them.
Yeah, I think we're always so negative about the Kings. It's kind of nice to be positive about them, at least for one weekend in June. And then, you know, once they overpay someone in free agency, we'll be right back to where we are usually. You know, another big loser, not really for what they did. I like Frank Ntilikina at the Knicks, but I think the Knicks are just such a dysfunctional organization right now. You know, the Kings, based on how they're drafting, they're keeping things a little more quiet, it seems, in the last year. Like, I think the Knicks are now the worst-run franchise in the NBA by far, possibly in, like, all of professional sports. I just can't understand how Phil Jackson still has his job the way he has undermined Carmelo Anthony. And now he's alienated Kristaps Porzingis, which is insane. It's like the best thing he's done by far. And now he's leaking trade rumors and for whatever reason, leaking that he's doing it because Kristaps skipped the exit meeting. So for that reason, I'm just worried about Frank Ntilikina's future because I have no faith in the Knicks developing talent. You know, they have Kristaps, they have Willy Hernan Gomez, who played really well last year. They have some intriguing young guys, but I just fear for Frank's future because, God forbid, the Knicks trade Kristaps. He's going to be the best prospect on that team. So, prayers up to Frank Ntilikina's NBA career. Mort, were there any other losers from the draft, or do you want to move on to the D'Angelo Russell trade?
Well, now that you mention it, let's move on to D'Angelo Russell, because honestly, I think we should break out the Lakers into what they did on draft night and then the trade, because I love what they did at the actual draft, like Thomas Bryant. There we go. I
love
that pick.
Yeah, and Josh Hart too.
Trade, and Josh Hart, yeah, as shooting guard coming in, they kind of need that, having rid themselves of D'Angelo. I was not a big fan of the trade though.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they sold low in terms of value. But then again, I mean, if a whole league is hell-bent on D'Angelo not being that guy and not having that value at all, then, who knows? But personally, I am opposed of trading low. I want to see where it can go, and considering that he's, 21, 22, I'm just not ready to rule it out. I would at least have given him another 6 months to see if he could raise it up a little bit. It is what it
is. For some context, we should mention we recorded an episode Tuesday, and then naturally an hour after we stopped recording, this D'Angelo trade happened. So it is D'Angelo Russell and Timofey Mozgov to the Brooklyn Nets for Brook Lopez and the number 27 pick, which they used to select Kyle Kuzma, I believe, or Kuzma, however you say his name. Basically, it's a salary dump for the Lakers. They wanted to get out of Mozgov's contract. Brook Lopez is on expiring. Brook Lopez is a really good player. He's going to help them win games next year. And then, the grand plan, it seems, is to get both Paul George and another max free agent next summer. There's been a lot of whispers about LeBron James wanting to go to LA. If not him, Russell Westbrook could be eligible. If he doesn't sign an extension, he could become a free agent in 2018. DeMarcus Cousins could become a free agent in 2018. So it sounds like that's kind of where the Lakers... We're back to Lakers' exceptionalism. We're back to where the Lakers... We could sign whoever we want, and everyone's going to come to us. So that just explains the kind of the Lakers' perspective. And there's been a lot of... I don't want to say chatter necessarily, but like Kevin Ding of Bleacher Report for months now has been kind of alluding to the Lakers not being as high on D'Angelo Russell as one would think. It seems like they're just concerned with I don't know what it means. They say leadership. Like, I don't know what about him, his personality or whatever, is rubbing them the wrong way, but clearly something did. They decided they wanted to build around Lonzo Ball. They didn't want to try the Ball-Russell pairing. So, Mark K., I know you and Mort were going back and forth on Twitter about this trade. You seem to be more understanding of it than Mort was. So why did you just tell me, like, what did you like it for the Lakers, or at least do you understand why they did it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I liked it. I wouldn't say I liked the deal. I understand it to a degree, and I think the way we judge the deal sort of almost needs to be reserved until we see what they do going forward. I mean, if they don't get anyone in free agency, if Paul George is the only guy they get, and LeBron doesn't come, Russell Westbrook has all these names, and they've just unloaded Timo Mozgov's deal and putting Russell on that package just to do so, then I think at that point we can say it's a pretty horrendous deal. But at the moment, I'm willing to give them time. But I guess it almost comes back to what you individually feel about Russell. I was never big on Russell, I guess, coming into the draft. And then once he came into the league, personally, I just didn't see anything that I would like to see from my point guard in terms of the way he plays. It's really hard to define the whole maturity aspect, because he is like a 19, 20-year-old sort of growing up in LA and on a team that's terrible, that had no direction at all in Kobe's last season. And then last season, he was effectively the leader of the team and it was running the offense. And it's a lot to ask for a point guard in LA to do, I guess. But personally, I was never high on Russell. So for me, I don't see it necessarily as huge in terms of giving up on him. Mm-hmm. But it all comes back to what you feel about D'Angelo. That said, I think he's pretty much gone to the perfect place for him in terms of going to Brooklyn and to be coached by Kenny Atkinson. Everyone talks about his developmental skills, and that's exactly what D'Angelo needs. And maybe this fresh start is the kick in the pants that he needs to sort of get his career back on tracks, because I think he had some pretty good numbers last year, but I'm not too sure if the intangibles are there, and that's purely subjective for me watching him, but who knows what it will be. But obviously the Lakers didn't necessarily feel that they could run Ball and Russell in the backcourt together, and I totally get that.
Yeah, I mean, the defensive concerns were very legitimate, not including any off-court leadership, etc. You know, there was the whole Snapchat thing with Nick Young his first year, and it's actually hilarious that Nick Young outlasted D'Angelo Russell by a day in terms of their Laker careers. Money would not have been on that last summer. But Mark, as you said, I think the Nets are the perfect place for him. I mean, hopefully it does give him that kind of extra motivation to realize, like, look, you know, I was the number two pick, but it doesn't matter. Like, I could easily flush out of the league. You know, Anthony Bennett was the number one pick and he's already out of the league. Jahlil Okafor was the number three pick. He's not going to play very much next year. Like, if I don't, you know, shape up or whatever, my NBA career could be a lot shorter than expected. And next to Jeremy Lin, I think, Mark, you alluded to, like, how you don't see him as this, you know, traditional pure point guard. And I agree. It seems like, you know, the Lakers were experimenting with him coming off the ball, especially toward the end of the last year. They were having Jordan Clarkson as their nominal point guard. So I think playing alongside Jeremy Lin in Brooklyn, at least for a year, is going to be pretty interesting.
I think a lot of it has to do with Magic as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Magic obviously being, you know, the previous point guard or one of the greatest Lakers, I guess, and seeing himself trying to identify himself in the point guards that the Lakers will be bringing through. I think he can see that in Lonzo Ball, but he probably couldn't see that in D'Angelo Russell at all. So when I'm thinking about this deal, to me, just personally, it's completely speculative, but I don't think Magic saw himself in, or saw a point guard that he could relate to in D'Angelo Russell, where he could see that in Lonzo Ball. And there is a quote going around on Twitter at the moment about D'Angelo from Magic, and he's essentially saying that D'Angelo wasn't a leader and that he wanted someone that can make, or someone that would be a leader and can make others around him better,
mm-hmm.
and a player that other players wanted to play with. So I mean, the stuff that we won't know because we weren't obviously in the locker rooms, but it just, for whatever reason, Magic has made the call that D'Angelo isn't necessarily a point guard of their future and he isn't necessarily a leader that he wants leading their young crew.
Yeah, as mentioned, Ding and both, actually Bleacher Report's Eric Pincus had a column that I had stumbled across the other day from March where it was like he had quotes from Magic and it really called Russell's leadership into question. So let's just store it in the back of our minds as he enters this new time in Brooklyn. Deeks, I want to ask you about Brook Lopez with the Lakers, because, you know, again, he's an expiring contract, so he will be off the books for unrestricted free agent 2018. Do you think he could be a long-term part of this Lakers core, or do you just view him as a one-year rental?
I think he should be a part of the Lakers core because he's good. Now, I appreciate, of course, the what you term Lakers exceptionalism, the plan for 2018. They should have a plan for greatness. They should not expect, but try to get this elite quality, and it's available via the free agency market. They're right to target that. However, that doesn't mean to dispense with Lopez. Lopez is really good, all right? Especially now that he's a high-volume three-point shooter. He's the rare rim-protecting, post-up playing three-point shooter trifecta. Who else does that? He's entering his prime. His prime is really good. He's eligible for an extension. Negotiate one. See what you can do. Appreciate still you want to have cap space opened up, but those deals are very doable. Okay, so in this instance, it meant giving up on Russell, who was once a prized part of the future. But hypothetically, gentlemen, sorry to talk about Chicago all day, but pretend that Rondo, we're this time next summer and Rondo's deal was exactly the same as it is now. Would you not take a future first round pick if Iguodala back and Luol Deng for Rondo right now? Yes, you would. Of course you would. The Lakers can do that. Zubac's a good prospect and the first round pick has some value, but they can move Deng's dead salary. They've moved Mozgov's. No one's going to need paying prior to that. So in the summer of 2018, they'll have a load of cheap youngsters. Brook Lopez, that's a team you want to join. So yeah, do keep Lopez. Keep him for at market value if possible. Get something for that. I totally agree with Mark Kay's comments on D'Angelo Russell. They wanted prime Manu Ginobili. They more sort of got Toronto era Mike James for the moment, but never mind. He's young and yeah, he probably is immature. That'll come with time. Not to worry. I agree that was a perfectly expendable part of the future because he wasn't the future that they're striving for. They're striving for greatness. Fine. I like it for both teams. I think being able to shift one part of the two terrible contracts that they signed last year in Mozgov and Deng was valuable. They did still get something for him in that they did get a first-round pick that they've used on Kuzma, who could be another Larry Nance. They also have Lopez. And yes, he's an expiring contract, but that shouldn't be where his value lies. His value should be in being a very high-quality NBA center who is still... there's still many years of his career left ahead of him, which will still be a high-quality NBA center. So I want to reject the use of the descriptor of him being as an expiring contract. He is more than that. For Brooklyn, given their lack of assets in the post-Billy King era, it's a good deal for them because whilst Lopez was their most valuable asset, he was about to stop being one unless they could extend his contract. So they've got something for him before he went. They're going to have to swallow the cost of Mozgov, but they can do that because there's nothing else they can do with the money anyway. So selective aggression in free agency, signing players such as Jeremy Lin and Trevor Booker, who they may be able to turn around for future picks because they're signed at market value. That sort of thing, combined with picking up on reclamation projects like this, is the way they're going to build a foundation without the control of their own draft picks. So I like it for them as well. I like it for both teams. You can't really often say that about a draft night deal, and Lord knows we didn't say it about Jimmy Butler. So, yeah, I know you want me to be negative, Brian, but I can't do it, buddy. Sorry.
No, that's fair. I'm kind of the same way. I mean, I love it for the Nets. As you said, like, this is the way they need to build because they have no picks until 2019. You know, D'Angelo Russell, you know, whatever you think of him, still a number two pick 2 years ago, still has enormous offensive potential, defensive concerns, of course, but, you know, the Nets just can't, they don't have avenues to get young talent like D'Angelo Russell. Like, he immediately has become their most valuable asset. And, like, this Brook Lopez deal came out of nowhere. I mean, no one was really, it's too early in the schedule, I guess, because you're focusing so much on 2017 free agents that you're not really thinking, at least in the forefront, about expiring contracts in 2018. But as you said, Mark, he's going to lose value by the day because, you know, he wasn't going to re-sign in Brooklyn in all likelihood. Like, why would he?
Well, he might have done. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. He might have done on account of the fact that he never expressed any qualms about being there, even as things fell apart around him. He was a loyal member of the team, never acted up, had value to them as a player going forward, certainly. There was mutual respect and trust there. He might have done. Nonetheless, it was a means of getting the young core talent that they generally otherwise lack. Right. So for them, it's cost them Lopez, who could have been that beautiful one-club man who spent his entire career there, but it was worth it for getting Russell. If they can now flank him by trying to do what they did last year with Alan Crabbe and Tyler Johnson, Johnson to sign quality youth to overly big deals and hoping the teams don't keep them. If they can try that strategy again with players like Jermichael Green and Otto Porter, they got a core. They didn't want to trade Lopez, I'm sure, other than the fact that it was their best means of getting to what they wanted slightly more than that. So I think he would have resigned, and I'm a little bit miffed because I've got to throw away a lot of words I wrote about the value of extending him in the future because I didn't see a trade like this coming. But nonetheless, it was for the best.
Yeah, well, you could just turn it into a Lakers column instead of a Nets column now.
I could do. Was it not exclusively about Brooklyn's situation going forward? Never mind. The love for Lopez remains.
Oh, that's good. Cool. Well, it is a good point. He might have re-signed there, especially because they can offer him more money. But even if he did, his timeline is different than where they are. Like, all of their best players are going to be in their early 20s. So, like, by the time that they are dug out of this hole that Billy King dug for them, he was not going to be in his prime anymore. So it was just a good use of assets for Brooklyn. I continue to be impressed by Sean Marks.
But even when you're going young, like, I think we get a bit binary about this sometimes as commentators. Even when you're going young, you still need quality veterans. Because we've just talked, for example, about Russell's perceived immaturity and lack of leadership. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that wouldn't be the case if they were still quality veterans. And I'm talking quality veterans. I'm not talking people that sit on the bench and occasionally come into the game and sit there and say good things to them on the sidelines. I'm talking players who will help them develop on the court by being good around them. If you want D'Angelo Russell to improve as a playmaker in the pick and roll, then give him a big who can actually roll for him. Give him someone to throw lobs to. Give him take your sixes, for example, Brian. They have lacked that, not so much last year, but in years prior, where the youth movement was so emphatic that they were all learning together and no one really knew what the right answers were, at which point it all comes down to coaching. You can have the best coaches in the world, and I'm a big fan of Brett Brown, but you need that on the that quality on the team which facilitates development. So even notwithstanding the fact that Lopez is, I think, 29, possibly 30, whichever it is in that area, just because his prime years don't match up with the prime years of whatever core they come to establish, he still had value there. Mm-hmm. You haven't got to only have good 24-year-olds. You can have quality veterans as well. And Lopez was that. He still is that. And he was and is eligible for an extension. So he needn't have even tested the market if they threw the money at him. So, yeah, I feel he would have resigned. And I feel he should resign with Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's going to be... I'm glad you say that, you know, they should at least keep him as a plan B, you know, if Paul George and LeBron doesn't come together. Like, Paul George and Brooke Lopez with Brandon Ingram, Lonzo Ball, Jordan Clarkson, you know, Julius Randle will be a free agent next year, but Larry Nance, like, that's an interesting...
And Zubac, don't forget Zubac. The boy's good.
Yeah, so they're building something. Like, I'm less upset. I was never upset that the Sixers traded the Lakers and Kings pick for Markelle Fultz because it was just such good value and, you know, that Fultz was just such a better fit. But, like, both the Lakers and the Kings, I would argue, got substantially better within the last week. And now, you know, those picks might not be as valuable as they were perceived to be a week ago. So, kudos, Brian Colangelo, for getting ahead of yourself there. I want to quickly turn to the Dwight Howard trade as well, which was just hilarious for a number of reasons, most notably because Dwight Howard decided to hold a Q&A on Twitter, like a... just like, ask me anything about the draft or free agency or trades. He gets one question, and then he gets traded to the Charlotte Hornets, and then his Q&A stops immediately. So he got Atlanta traded him to Charlotte, so Atlanta gave up him and the 31 pick, or the 41 pick, maybe. I don't remember. It doesn't. I think they gave up 31.
Yeah, it was.
They went down 10 picks.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So they gave up Dwight and 31 to Charlotte for Miles Plumlee, Marco Bellinelli, and 41. I mean, you know, I think at this point we know what Dwight is. I think he'll be... It's not going to hurt Charlotte because Miles Plumlee wasn't good. and they got to move up 10 spots in the second round. So I want to focus more on the Atlanta side of things. More, what do you think this trade means for Paul Millsap's future in Atlanta? Do you think, is this the signal of the start of a rebuild, and are they not going to offer him the huge contract that he's likely to receive otherwise?
So I don't remember if the whole Millsap is probably going to get better contracts elsewhere comment came before or after the Dwight trade, but it was made, I mean, regardless. So I don't think it would have had an impact either way. It just seems like they are trying to rebuild, push the big red button, and then just starting over, essentially. Because I can't imagine you keep him when you say something like that,
right?
In public, like he's not going, you know, he's going to get a better offer elsewhere. Okay, that's just like by now.
Yeah.
So I don't think that had any effect whatsoever.
Do you agree with the decision for Atlanta to finally, like the Bulls, choose a direction and move toward a rebuild?
Yeah, I don't think they had like, you know, one foot in each camp like the Bulls, you know, did. I think they generally tried winning and tried staying competitive. In terms of whether or not this is the right direction, who's to say? They have some youngsters with some potential. I'm not overly in love with any of them, but it's decent, I suppose. So it depends on what they're going to do. Like, if they're going to blow the whole thing up, then I'm curious to see what they do. Like, they have to move Kent Bazemore as well later on. Yeah, that deal is horrendous now.
Yeah, it really is.
But, I mean, what can you really do just with Paul Millsap? Paul Millsap is absolutely amazing. So he's going to take you, like, a fair bit down the road, but then at some point, that's about it. And then he's better served elsewhere.
Yeah.
Like, I would love him in Boston, for example.
Yeah, and they're going to have the money because they didn't spend it on, you know, they didn't spend their capital.
He's a nice fallback if they don't get, you know, Gordon Hayward.
Or Blake Griffin, yeah.
Or Blake Griffin, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really all we need to say about this trade because, frankly, it's not going to move the needle for either team a huge amount, at least until we see how the rest of free agency shakes out. So instead, I want to wrap things up this week by talking about the salary cap, which came in $2 million less than expected. The NBA is currently projecting it to be $99 million instead of $101 million. So Deeks, as our cap expert here, what does that mean for free agency?
I'm glad you came to me because I can use this to segue to talk about the Dwight Howard deal for both teams because it is relevant because I don't like the situation for either team. I'm not talking about the trade necessarily, but the situation prior. Atlanta's in a little bit of purgatory where they've tried to reload without rebuilding, but have lost the quality players from their 60-win team without getting assets in return, and Millsap may be the continuation of that, whereas Charlotte are capped out and not very good. So for them, the Dwight Howard trade has to work, gentlemen. It has to work. Dwight has to become something that he's not been. Because look at their salary picture. They don't drive the revenues of the other teams around them that have these similar heavy payrolls. And yet their payroll is stacked. Batum is starting a massive deal. Howard's on a big deal. Zeller's starting a big deal. Marvin Williams is on too big of a deal. They are threatened by the tax. So it's not just the cap that's coming down. The tax is coming down. Charlotte is, I think, 37-win team with not much incumbent of a core other than Zeller and Walker. They are capped out. They are now almost taxed out with Dwight. And they're not that good. The deal to bring in Plumlee, they traded Spencer Hawes and Roy Hibbert to get Plumlee, who wasn't being used. I think he averaged about 2-2 for $12 million per. It was very ambitious. Plumlee can be good and was good in Phoenix when he played, but he's a marginal starting talent. So they loaded up on salary to get him. Now they're loading up even more in the hope that a player who has steadily declined in both ability and luster and value is going to be the answer to their myriad problems on the court. And, ouch, that's a big gamble, because what's the resolution if it doesn't work? What if they don't crack 40 next year? Are they going to the playoffs and they get knocked out straight away? Then what? Who's expiring readily? The only really Walker, and he's the one you need. So I don't like their situation. And as for Atlanta, it wasn't so much a commitment to a rebuild because they didn't get anything of value. They got Plumlee, who's an expensive backup, and Bellinelli, who's going to be a mediocre to decent veteran for 1 year and then walk. For them, it was addition by subtraction. It's not a commitment to a rebuild, and it doesn't necessarily free up their salary picture any. It's just that Dwight didn't want to be there, and he didn't really help them, which is not a glowing endorsement of Dwight, but that's what he's become at this point. It must be difficult. Well, it should be difficult for him to look at Houston now and see how Clint Capella is doing and think, yeah, that could have been me if I'd have been a bit more humble and stopped posting up once every two trips. Anyway, with regards to free agency, the cap coming in slightly lower, it's enough to make a little bit of a difference. It does, of course, affect the size of various max salaries. It's all relative, but yes, it does affect it a little bit. It brings the tax down as well, which will affect a couple of teams, including the LA Clippers. If they want to be able to re-sign their players, it's going to cost them. Charlotte, as we've talked about. I think, and I'm not an economist, so I need to be careful of trying to sound like I know more than I do here, but I think it's more indicative of the fact that for the big spikes we've had in the last couple of years, it looks like things will plateau and will level off. The cap may increase in the next 4 or 5 years, but it might not be very much. What we just saw then was a very random period, a very unique standout period of 2 year cap spikes that has manifested itself into contracts like those for Solomon Hill and Ken Bazemore and Timothy Mozgov, but which won't continue. Now, there are a couple of teams who went out and spent on players not really fitting, perhaps in the belief that the cap will continue to rise astronomically, or at least consistently, in a way that it now looks like it won't. They're the ones that are going to feel the crunch. I mentioned a couple of deals there. Bazemore, yeah, ouch, that's a bad one. Luol Deng's deal, God bless him, that's not a good deal. These kind of things are going to become obstructive. The new CBA and the one prior to that has made contracts shorter. There's a lot more on guaranteed salary, which for incumbent deals can still be used in trade in the way it was prior. There's a new rule about how unguaranteed and partially guaranteed salaries are only used in trade for the amounts of the guaranteed salary rather than the entire amount. That's only for new contracts. There's a lot of old contracts who still have unguaranteed years. They'll still have trade value. Rondo, for example, that we talked about before. There's still mechanisms then for a lot of financial movement. And the with that in mind, the unguaranteed and the expiring contracts, is particularly the expiring contract, which used to be of immense value and tapered off a bit as the cap freed up and there was more free agency movement, is now going to come back in. Because teams have loaded up on their salary picture in anticipation of a growing cap that may not now grow. They're going to want to shift that. Morton talked earlier about Evan Turner on the Blazers. The Blazers have way too much salary for a 41-win team. They got carried away last year, and I'm sure they'll tell you. The Turner contract is a particularly poor one. Myers Leonard's, I had no idea what the plan was there. Alan Crabb got, I think it was 73 million, 70-something million, and for an 11 PER and a few corner three-pointers. Now, it's not that the salary cap level affects them, it's the tax level. They're over it. They're now going to be more over it. The tax, gentlemen, is layered. So the more you pay, the higher over it you are, the more you pay. That's going to get pricey for them. They can clearly afford quite a lot of tax, hence they made the decisions that they did. But it completely destroys any flexibility to change and improve their team, which they're going to need because they're not close right now. So the knock-on effects is not so much, I think, the free agency, because when we're talking the 2 million difference, we're talking about a 2% difference, not hugely significant. It's more the stagnation that it reflects and the impact it will have on the teams who didn't account for that properly in their overspends of the last 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's really interesting to me, right? So the new CBA, incumbent teams can offer 8% raises a year. Other teams could offer 5% raises a year. When these contracts were all signed, you know, $24 million jump last year, $5 million jump this year, you know, not as much as expected, still big. But it does seem like it's going to level off to the point where the raises are going to increase higher than the cap is percentage-wise. Like, there's not going to be an 8% jump every year. So these contracts that were signed, you know, when everyone was just throwing around money like drunken sailors last year, are only going to become exponentially worse and exponentially more restrictive over the coming 2 or 3 years. So, yeah, it's going to be... I'm really interested to see whether, you know... Of course, the top-tier guys are going to get the maxes because that's what happens. Like, there are guys who don't necessarily deserve maxes, like a Chandler Parsons, say, who's going to get it just because that's how the market is. But I'm interested to see whether these mid-tier guys, the guys we all mentioned, Mozgov, Deng, Evan Turner, Bazemore, even Alan Crabb, who I like and is young and is fun and is a good prospect, if they get these massive four-year $70 million, four-year $75 million deals, because if they do, you know, I would think the Mozgov contract, like, look what the Lakers had to ship up the number two overall pick just to attach him as the salary dump. So, you know, it proves that, like, one mistake can really come back to bite you in the ass. So that's, it's going to be a fun summer, gentlemen. I'm very excited. Mark K., any final thoughts on free agency, the Bulls, et cetera, before we head out?
Look, to be honest with you, I haven't even thought that far ahead. I'm still reeling from yesterday. So I have honestly no idea what the Bulls are going to do from a free agent perspective. I guess they're going to hold on to Mirotić, hopefully re-sign him and potentially trade him on later on, like Mark said. That way they don't lose an asset for nothing once more, like they've continuously done. But in terms of the larger free agency piece, the name I'm really intrigued to see is Chris Paul and what he does. We saw Pau Gasol opt out of his deal. There was rumblings about a Danny Green potential trade. I'm wondering if there's some sort of wheeling and dealing that the Spurs and Paul have already started to begin, or if they're just laying the potential groundworks of some deals that may need to happen should Paul decide to go to the Spurs. But I want to really see that. So that's my main focus heading into free agency, to see what Chris Paul does, because I think that could shape, I could almost shape the rest of the Western Conference for next season and how that looks. So yeah, that's my main takeaway heading forward. But yeah, as I said, still reeling from that Jimmy Butler trade.
Reasonable. Yeah, I mean, the Chris Paul thing is going to be interesting, especially, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge rumors started popping up on draft day. So we will, hopefully, yep. Sarah will be back next time. We could talk to her about kind of the state of the Spurs heading into free agency. Until then, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us today. Mark Deeks, remind our listeners where they can find you on Twitter and all of your work.
Alan Crabb is not a good prospect. Mark Deeks NBA is my Twitter handle. Some love to Scal BCA, but by the way, I didn't pay that forward earlier when I was talking about the Kings. Got love for Scal.
Okay, good stuff. And Mark Kavanzoulis, where can they find you on Twitter?
They can get me at MarkKNBA. That's probably the easiest way to find me, definitely.
Perfect. All right. Well, yeah, give these two a follow. They're both really smart guys. Mark Kavanzoulis will give you all the Bulls shade you could want. Deeks will have some great cap insights and just general NBA analysis. Otherwise, give us a follow on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find all of our handles in our bio, so check us out there as well. Also, download us on iTunes, subscribe. We'd love any feedback, reviews, etc. And we are being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports, and for their NBA content at FanRag NBA. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined by Morten Jensen, Mark Kavanzoulis, and Mark Deeks. Have a good one, guys. Enjoy the weekend.
You too, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
See ya.
Welcome to Total Wine & More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in-store or online at TotalWine.com.